My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
You are listening to Intergenerational Politics with Jill Winebanks and Victor Xu, where we host weekly political discussions that are engaging and relevant to all generations with experts on various issues facing our country today.
This is Victor Xu. I'll be an incoming freshman at UCLA next year and also the youngest Joe Biden delegate here in Illinois. Jill, can you give us a brief introduction about who you are?
Sure. I'm the co-host with Victor, and I am also a Biden delegate. I'm the author of The Watergate Girl, which I hope you'll all read, based on my experience as the only woman trial attorney in the Watergate case. I also served as general counsel of the Army, as Solicitor General and Deputy Attorney General of the state of Illinois. And maybe more relevant to this conversation, I was the Chief Officer for Career and Technical Education for the Chicago Public Schools, and so have some background in administration of a school program. And we're very excited today to have an expert who Victor will be introducing.
Yeah. So as always, we want to thank you for listening to Intergenerational Politics. On our show today, we'll be discussing the topic of reopening schools amid coronavirus. We've already been seeing schools reopening and others are just days or weeks from reopening. So to help us understand what schools will need to do to reopen safely, we're so excited to be joined by Elaine Maiman. And because of her book and her current research, we will also be discussing using this moment to improve higher education in general. Until a few weeks ago, Dr. Elaine Maiman was the president of Governor State University, the only public university in the south suburbs of Chicago. Through her 13 years as president, she helped lead GSU through the Great Recession of 2008, the Illinois state budget and its last months of her presidency, and the first phase of this coronavirus pandemic. Before heading GSU, Dr. Maiman was the chancellor of the University of Alaska Anchorage and vice president of Arizona State University, where she led the West Campus. She has also served on the boards of the American Council of Education, the American Association of Colleges and Universities, and will soon be at the American Council on Education. She's also a prolific writer in professional publications and is the author of Leading Academic Change, Vision, Strategy, and Transformation. So thank you so much for being here, Elaine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so I want to jump right into the conversation today. The debate of reopening schools has received a lot of attention in the media lately. Many peers are already beginning to go to school. Some have already gone to school. But what we've been seeing during the coronavirus pandemic is schools grappling with how to reopen without putting their faculty, professors, community, and students in harm's way. A handful of schools have opted for this complete reopening model. Some have opted for a hybrid model, and others have just shifted completely to online learning, as you are well aware. As the president of GSU, you dealt with the first phase of the coronavirus pandemic. So what do you suggest as guidelines for reopening schools and colleges in the fall?
I think it's always important to work from principle. And let me just say what the three principles are that have guided me in my decisions in the first phase of the COVID crisis, and that I suggest can guide grade school through grad school. The first one is respect science. Educational institutions, we have core values in terms of being the teachers of science, those at the universities who do scientific research and develop science. And we have to stay true to that principle. We are science-based institutions, and we have an obligation to help the public understand science, reject pseudoscience and magical thinking. We have to make decisions based on evidence. And the evidence in different localities is going to be somewhat different. But we have to be sure to look at it objectively and carefully. The other thing we need to do is to help the public understand that science is iterative. We change hypotheses and continue to test them. We don't find permanent solutions. So, for example, very early on in February, early March, Dr. Fauci had some questions about masks. And of course, he was referring then to the more technical kind of mask that has to be preserved for healthcare workers. Now, he is emphatically, based on further research, saying that not masks so much as face coverings are absolutely essential to stop the spread of the virus. And yet he is criticized because, oh, well, back in February, you said no masks and now you're saying masks. That is a ignorant misunderstanding of science. And we in education have to be in the forefront of helping to explain that. So that's the first principle. The second principle is respect teachers, staff, students, and communities. And what that means is the top priority in that respect is to protect the health and safety of all of those constituents. That's our first priority. That was my first priority as president of a university, whatever the circumstance was, I had to make a decision so that I protected the health and safety of anyone at the institution. The second way to respect these different constituents is to make sure that education is of the highest quality, whether it's remote, hybrid, or in person. It has to be of the highest quality. It can't be cutting corners online education can be remarkable. It has to be remarkable if we're going to be doing it more so than we've been doing it before. We have to analyze course goals and determine how to meet those goals on various platforms. That's the key. It isn't, well, what percentage are you going to be remote or so forth and so on. You have to look course by course at how you're going to achieve your goals. The third principle is be creative. Innovate with remote delivery. This is an opportunity to do all kinds of interesting things and to make remote delivery more interactive than a 300 student lecture, to tell you the truth. And we have to also find new ways to create relationships online, because that is so key in education at any level, from grade school to grad school. And then third, we have to use this catastrophic time to plan for a different future in education.
Yeah, for sure. I think just to kind of reiterate those three pillars. So one is, you know, respecting science, respecting teachers, the staff, the community at the school, being creative, and then lastly, knowing that this moment will definitely bring about changes to higher education, hopefully for the better. So in terms of these pillars, what we've been seeing with colleges that have begun to reopen or are kind of like working through that phase is kind of like dealing with those three pillars with some of these guidelines for in-person learning. So we see, you know, social distancing, cleaning, testing, contact tracing, you know, kind of restricting how many people go into gyms and the dormitory hallways. But one big requisite for all those things is funding and money. So we know that many elite private institutions, you know, like Harvard and Yale and some of those top institutions, those funds aren't really a big problem for them. But for public universities and for smaller colleges that, you know, don't really have as big of an endowment, how difficult is it to find and maintain some of these guidelines? And if they don't have the funding, does that mean that they don't reopen or that they have to cut funding from other activities like sports and extracurriculars? Like, how should this be handled from like that funding aspect?
Well, before the pandemic, in this topsy-turvy society, public institutions that are doing the major work in educating what I call the new majority have been seriously underfunded. And it's just been wrong. When I say the new majority, let me define that. That means first generation students of color, adults, and military veterans. Those students were marginalized for a very long time. They are now the majority. And one of the major changes that needs to occur and be accelerated this year is more attention to that group that is the majority. Now, in terms of funding, what I have recommended to institutions of various places on the economic scale, that this year is a year for investment. That sounds counterintuitive, but what that means is that for the public universities, I know right now in Congress, there's a big debate about further assistance to the states and to the public universities. The proponents, mostly Democrats, I will say, who are arguing for more support to the states and to the public universities must win, because the states and the public universities need this support. I think we are very accustomed in the public sector to do what we can with what we can. And so the public investment should be coming forward, but I know at Governor's State, I made sure that we built reserves during over the years, mm-hmm. and you don't like to use your reserves. It's not a good idea, but this is a year when that investment is going to pay off, not only in human terms, but I would argue in financial terms. Also, I think, again, we have to look at things we never looked at before. I know that private institutions are very reluctant to use their endowment, the kind of flexible monies, and that's not a lot, but some is flexible, to use money from their endowments. This is the year to do it. For the public universities that don't have the endowments, I would suggest doing radical kinds of things. The Federal Reserve has loans called Main Street loans, which that public universities that are really trying to make an effort to build for the future should look into. So in short, no, you don't close. No, you don't cut the things that really represent your future. And what you do is you invest, you make sure you keep people working, and you make sure that you are rethinking your whole way of doing things this year, so that when we come out on the other side of this, we're going to be prepared to do things a whole lot better and more financially stable.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just being creative, like you had mentioned, that last pillar, being creative is definitely so important in this unprecedented time. But kind of shifting now towards kind of the experience that many freshmen and just college students and high school students will be experiencing is, you know, integral part of the college experience is not only being able to interact with, you know, faculty and peers, whether that's in the class or the dorms or at club meetings, but also using the college's facilities. Obviously with COVID-19, these interactions will be severely limited. For my generation, many of whom will be incoming freshmen next year at universities and colleges across the nation, how difficult will it be for colleges to provide a full college experience? We'll get into deferring and kind of the options for students later, but so how difficult will that be, and how can they provide those, I guess, traditional college experiences while also enforcing some of those guidelines like social distancing, mask wearing, that are necessary to reopen schools safely?
Well, first of all, it's going to be different. That's just the way it is. And that's something that students need to learn, that the world changes. And we have to find ways to be productive and find ways for self-fulfillment within those changes. Mm-hmm. And so whatever the proportion of online, hybrid, face-to-face, that's going to be a necessity. And that's where my three principles, you know, come in very importantly. We have to respect the science, respect each other, and be creative. And I think there are many ways to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now this is a particular concern from some of the out-of-state students. So next year I'll be going to UCLA. I'm here in Chicago. And so let's say that there is an outbreak of COVID-19 on campus if we kind of do go back to campus. So in that case, I'd assume that, you know, many students will be panicked that it may spread to the rest of the campus. And those students will have to quarantine for at least 2 weeks, which will impact the professors and also the students' learning experience. So if there was an outbreak of COVID-19 on campus, would colleges have to send their kids back to home? Can they keep their students on campus knowing that a student who has COVID-19 may spread it to other faculty members and students? Like, how would these kind of issues be grappled with if there were an outbreak of COVID-19 on campus?
Well, first of all, it's going to be different given the different circumstances of the various institutions. Mm-hmm. For Governor State University, for example, we are mainly a commuter campus. We have a very small proportion of the students living in Prairie Place, you know, which is our living learning community, where we have three faculty members living. So it really will be a living learning community. We never closed Prairie Place. We didn't close in February, March, April. Why? Because it was the safest and healthiest place for the students who chose to stay there. We made it possible for any student who lived nearby, wanted to go home, you know, get a refund on the rent. Now, that wasn't the issue. But we have a number of students who live in Englewood, a section of Chicago, which is not a healthy place. It wasn't healthy before the pandemic in many places. And I mean, let me just give great respect to the people of Englewood and you know, the great work that they are doing to make it a healthier place. But the fact of the matter was that our students wanted to stay in Prairie Place and to be semi-quarantined there. So fortunately, we didn't have any outbreak. I think the students were very appreciative of being on campus. We had very strictly enforced procedures. The campus was not crowded. I mean, we didn't have on campus person-to-person classes, with very rare exceptions. Nonetheless, we did have, we had certain people who had to work on campus. We had our police, our buildings and grounds. We had others who had to be there from time to time. But I think those who were there had a strong appreciation of our allowing them to be there. And we didn't have any challenges in terms of the masks, in terms of the social distancing, and so forth. Now, that's a different situation. Let me use University of Illinois as another example, because I think they are doing an amazing job. First of all, their scientists in epidemiology have developed a saliva test for COVID, and you can get the results in 4 hours. I do not know why this isn't more widely distributed across the United States. I mean, 4 hours. I mean, it isn't getting tested, it's getting the results through the testing. I mean, if you have to wait more than 48 hours for your results, you might as well not have taken the test. So University of Illinois, there's an article in the Tribune today. They're going to have everyone on campus tested twice a week with the saliva test. Mm-hmm. So they're going to, you know, be able to have very good knowledge about who needs to be quarantined, sent home, whatever space they're going to reserve on the campus for quarantine. The other thing, and that's important, and then let me just make another point. I know that Governor State University, Moraine Valley Community College, we are giving instruction to people in contact tracing. You talk about employment. That's an area that is just so in need of more people who can trace contacts for those who have been exposed. And I would just say that every community college and public university should be providing some education in contact tracing, because it's not a formulaic or easy thing to do. I mean, you have to be able to ask people some questions that they're not going to want to answer. You have to be a little bit of a social worker. You're going to have to be a very good communicator. And this is not something you just know how to do naturally. So in any case, my general answer to your question is that it's situational. It has to do, you know, with the nature of the student population. It has to do with what they're doing with testing.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, so obviously for those colleges that are reopening or are thinking about doing some like hybrid model of in-person online learning, like those guidelines are so essential for bringing those students back to campus. But for those colleges that are staying online, a lot of my peers, including myself, are considering the possibility of deferring a quarter, semester, or year because of that, you know, option of, you know, we don't want to pay for tuition given that, you know, it'll all be online classes and that, you know, it'll be interrupt with kind of the traditional college experience. But given that many of the colleges will be either all online or some form of hybrid mode, is it worth for students to pay for such high tuitions, but lacking that vital in-person that instruction and experience that makes college such a unique time in our life?
Well, first of all, I really believe it's very important for students to be in a structured academic environment, but it doesn't have to be the conventional one. I think that, again, it goes into my point about being creative. I mean, congratulations in UCLA, it's a great place. I think you'll be very successful there. And, you know, what I would recommend that you do is to talk to the people at UCLA. Start with the admissions office, but then get connected with a professor, a political science professor, or a professor who would be interested in doing an independent study with you where you could not just do your podcast and be a delegate at the Democratic Convention, but the important academic part of that is reflecting on it. And, you know, doing what you would need to do according to your professor to show those reflections. Maybe it would be in podcast form. Maybe you do a podcast reflecting on the experience as a delegate or whatever. Yeah. But I would try to work out something that would involve your enrollment at UCLA, but with your opportunity to do something creative that would be academically very sound. And it would be a win-win situation because the universities and colleges that are creative in this way are going to be the ones that are going to emerge from all of this in the best places. And for you, Victor, you know, there's certain kind of practical things that you will miss out on if you are not enrolled anywhere. You know, for example, in the spring under the Federal CARES Act, universities were able to give students funds to for anything, but it was mainly so that they could increase their technological capacities. They could not have to make a choice between food and a new computer. And Governor State University was able to give up to $1,000 to each student who made a brief application, but who was also FAFSA eligible because of the federal guidelines that had to be. If you're not in school at all, you're not gonna be eligible for anything that the government comes up with. And I sure hope they come up with something in these negotiations this week on what's called the HEROES Act from the House. But so let's say that things don't work out with UCLA and you can't arrange for this kind of independent study where you'd be an enrolled student. The other option for you and for other students is to enroll in a local regional public like Governor State or community college, make sure that you would be taking courses that UCLA would take and transfer, and you can get approval in advance for that with your deferring admission. You would have to talk to people there, get something in writing that would show that your courses would transfer. But then you would still be in a structured educational environment. And I think it's a good thing anyway, because this coming year is going to be a year of tremendous ambiguity, tremendous stress. Mm-hmm. And I think that the more that students can be in a structured environment with that kind of larger support system that you have from education, the better off the student will be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just when this pandemic started in high school, like being a graduating high school senior, like a lot of my peers were saying how like when this first started, it was just the lack of structure that really got to them and kind of affected their learning environment. So I do think that maintaining that structure is important, but kind of finding, like you said, those creative ways that you can maintain that structure, whether it's this independent study or whether it's, you know, going to community college. I think it's definitely advice that I hope all students will listen to and really follow. But I do know that Jill wants to ask some questions, so I'll hand it to her.
So once again, Elaine, thank you very much for joining us and for this great conversation. I want to start with maybe a slightly different perspective, which is instead of from the student's point of view, I want to talk about parents and school administrators and their point of view. There's been a recent sort of kerfuffle locally about reopening schools where the school said, no, we're not reopening. It's too dangerous to the faculty. It's too dangerous to the students, and health concerns just are predominant. But parents were arguing that their students needed the social interaction and in-person instruction, and that online wasn't as good. And so they were pushing for the school to reopen. So how do you balance reopening safely, whether it's, you know, totally online or some kind of hybrid, with the desire of parents to have a complete reopening with total in-person education? And I suppose even with you know, the pressure of the Trump administration to let the economy get started by letting schools reopen so that parents don't have to stay home to educate their children or to even just supervise their children, they could go back to work. How do you balance that?
Well, I'll go back to my principles: respect science, respect each other, and be creative. The idea is that, yes, there's scientific evidence on the importance for children to have interactions and so forth. You know what really, though, just a tangential item, just puzzles me. The Trump administration and others have been such proponents before of homeschooling, that homeschooling was, you know, the thing to do. And now suddenly they are the great proponents of opening the public schools.
Although I do want to add, I think that his grandson, Barron, is going to be starting online school, like completely at home, which many people have been like, why is he doing online school? But then Trump is forcing all these schools to reopen. It just seems hypocritical in that sense, but yeah.
Well, it is remarkable. But, you know, I think that the whole idea is that you have to look at the scientific evidence in the different areas. And you've got to take this thing out of politics.
Yes.
Yeah. Because there's scientific evidence that has to be balanced. And remember, science is not exact. You have to always be balancing the various pieces of scientific evidence. Yes, students do need the interaction. We have a six-year-old granddaughter who was just yearning to go back to school. I mean, it was kindergarten canceled for her this year. And she had, she's in a wonderful school district, and the kindergarten teacher would do one-on-one with the kids. And I think it's going to be a whole lot even better for first grade, but for crying out loud, it's first grade. You know, she was just on the verge of reading, and in any case, so I'm very sympathetic with, you know, the scientific evidence that says that students need the social interaction, but that's not the whole picture. It doesn't help anybody if the children are not, maybe they're not getting sick themselves, but if they are carriers and are, you know, creating illness in staff and teachers, that's not going to help the economy. That's not going to help education. It's not going to help anybody. So these things really have to be balanced. The other thing is that, you know, we have to respect teachers. If you have a teacher who has a pre-existing condition or is vulnerable in what we know scientifically is going to put that teacher at very great risk, I don't think there's any way that that teacher should be forced out of quarantine. And, you know, and doing anything but doing it remotely. I just believe that very strongly. You just don't do that to people in terms of, you know, forcing them to choose between their livelihood and their health. But then my third point in terms of being creative, that's the key. We had to go into the quarantine very suddenly in March. And even with that, I am so proud of faculty members at Governor State University. The things that they did creatively during that quarantine, I'll give you an example. An art teacher was teaching printmaking, helped the students through Zoom and other ways to use household items, magazines and other kinds of things to transfer images. And this is something, I mean, this is a great thing to learn, that you don't need, you know, kind of very high powered printmaking equipment, you know, to be an artist. And another art faculty, I'm very proud of our art faculty, was a ceramics teacher. And she did videos on helping the students individually in their homes, you know, do the clay pots. And then she went door to door, social distance, wow, picked them all up, took them into the kilns in our art studios and fired them. That's the kind of creativity that we need to see just on steroids as we go into the new academic year. The idea that the teachers have developed ways to be more creative, more engaging, using the technology in ways that has never been used before in order to make it productive. So as I say, those three principles still hold for decisions on this matter.
Thank you. I have to say, listening made me remember in my era using a potato to carve an image in to create a Christmas card one year. So that was my printmaking back then.
There you go.
But also listening to you made me, I have a whole series of questions, but I want to sort of jump ahead in my mind to one about some of the benefits that might come out of this, the opportunities for positive change that this COVID pandemic may allow for high schools, colleges, universities more broadly. I know you've thought about this a great deal and written about it. And if you could just sort of give us a brief description of what you think positive could happen as a result of these challenges.
Yes. In fact, if listeners want to look at my article that was published last week, it's in a publication called Inside Higher Education. It's the online newspaper of record for universities and colleges. And the article is called From Triage to Transformation. And the point of the article is that we are not simply dealing with a worldwide pandemic. We're dealing with the confluence of the pandemic with a heightened awareness of social justice and an economic cataclysm. All three interacting. And in fact, they are interrelated in, you know, very important ways. And so this is a moment, and there was a great deal of reform going on. I'll talk about higher education now for a moment, but it really does apply across the board in terms of reforms that make our institutions places where the new majority of students can find self-fulfilling education. And I know that Governor State was very much involved in these reforms and continues to be so. And a number of other reform-minded institutions have been working on these means. I'm very proud of my service on the board of the American Council on Education. And I do refer listeners and viewers to look at the names of the board members of that group, because it's an amazing across the different sectors reform-minded group. Georgia State University, University of Southern New Hampshire, take a look. But my point is that those reforms were started, and I look at this coming academic year as a time to accelerate those reforms. I see it as a now or never situation. And I see that there are tremendous stakes, very high stakes. In fact, our democracy is basically in question. And this is the year, this is why I say it has to be a year of investment. This is a year when we have to accelerate what we have already been thinking about doing. For example, on the first year in college, where we have to be sure that full-time, fully committed professors who are engaged not only with teaching, but with research on that first year, are engaged with students. At most types of institutions. In a place like UCLA, Victor, I would settle for the full-time faculty, let us say in English composition, you know, working with a very heightened preparation of graduate students to be committed to the first year student. And, you know, not modeling it by having a few of them teaching it. This is something the University of Pennsylvania, my alma mater, did a number of years ago. That is, you think, I don't know if people realize how revolutionary that is in higher ed, but it is, because there's this thing called the Maiman hierarchical fallacy, where professors tend to think that if I teach graduate students and you teach freshmen, I must be smarter than you. And we have to get over that. And this is the year to get over it. We have to, another kind of snobism in higher education, which really gets in our way, is the partnerships between four-year universities and community colleges. The vast majority of students of color and first-generation students begin at community colleges. And we have some absolutely top-notch community colleges in this country. And we have to find pathways for the students who have begun at community colleges to go on for a four-year bachelor's degree and beyond. Now, again, Governor State University has modeled this. We've got national recognition for our pathway program called the DDP program. I recommend that, again, people look it up. It's called the dual degree program. It's not dual enrollment, that's different. It's 2 degrees, associate degree, and bachelor's degree. So those are just some examples of what we need to do this year in order to come out on the other end of this, ready to have reformed, reimagined, transformed educational systems that will then carry us through for the rest of the century.
One thing for sure, Dr. Mammon is a transformational leader. I was privileged to be on her president's advisory council for a number of years now while she was president. And I saw firsthand how she dealt with the budget crisis in Illinois, where there was no state funding. Yeah. And she was, you know, already into the semester trying to figure out how she was going to pay to staff, faculty, provide the housing. I also saw her transform Governor's State from a two-year junior senior only, which is unusual. Most community colleges, or many maybe freshman sophomore, but they were a school that was only for juniors and seniors. And she transformed it to a four-year school and then added a residential facility as well. So she's really a transformational leader. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad we've had your input on this. Maybe just a few more brief questions before we wrap up. Because you've written a lot about higher education and leadership, and you know, we've talked now about what COVID-19 could do to actually improve higher education. What do you think are some of the specific challenges right now for educational leaders and institutions in this academic year starting now?
Well, I think that it's just human nature. When you have to do triage, that can be all you do. Because it is just so panicky, so all-absorbing. And so I think the real challenge is to go beyond triage to transformation. In my article in Inside Higher Education, I talk about from cocoons, butterflies. And we have to really be thinking about that metaphorically. So that's a very important challenge. And the other challenge is that it is just so disheartening to see how all of this is being politicized. and, you know, basically, you know, misrepresented with, we need the public to have a better sense of what's at stake here. And the importance of education, and your podcast is very important. I hope a lot of people listen, but we have to find as many means as we can, because, you know, we are working at cross purposes with some of the political kinds of statements that are going around out there. And one of the worst things is this attack on science. I mean, that is just horrendous.
So we will be posting a link to your article so that our listeners can all read it themselves. And again, maybe one or two last questions. I want to focus on the cost of tuition. Victor and I have been talking about his upcoming college experience. And of course, I'm very concerned about not having the full experience and still paying the full tuition once I learned how much tuition for out-of-state students is. And then I checked my own alma mater, where of course I went as an in-state student at the University of Illinois downstate. And it's hard for me to imagine how anyone can afford to go to school. So with the rapidly rising costs, is there something that we can say to parents or students and something that we can do to control those costs in order to allow students to attend? Is there any reality to free college, even at the, you know, community college or the state-run school level? What can we do about tuition?
Well, two ways to address that. Let me say that Governor State's motto right now is learn local. And I think it's very important for students in Illinois to recognize the extremely high quality of education that can be obtained here. I mean, I think that I'm so proud of the faculty. I'm so proud of what we offer at Governor State University. Any student going there, which is the lowest tuition and mandatory fees in the state of Illinois, is going to be very well served. So I think that I think families should be looking at that be thinking about that. That's number one. Number two, as I mentioned earlier, we're looking for very strong, viable, creative pathways from community college to universities, four-year pathways. We can counsel students at Governor State University to graduate without debt, whether they're in the dual degree program, or we provide some additional support, or we, in our four-year undergraduate program, we are able through student employment, which we are sustaining. Students are employed, they're working remotely, they're doing all kinds of interesting things, but we can help students figure it out so that they can graduate without debt. But let me take it from the other standpoint, because let's look at the private liberal arts colleges. Let's look at, you know, the Ivy League. I'm an Ivy League graduate myself on full scholarship. I think students and families have to take into account, what is it that they are really paying for there? You're paying for the prestige of the institution. You are paying for whatever interaction the institution is going to provide for you, in terms of whether it's Zoom or whatever, you know, whatever creative things they're going to do, so that you're going to be a Yaley or you're going to be a UCLA person. And of course, the rich institutions are really quite generous about enormous financial aid packages, where you can actually, where students who are in need can actually have no debt when they graduate. And I don't know if the general public even quite understands that, but it's true. You know, so I think that it really is a question of, you know, families thinking through your values. Let me go back to the public sector, and you know, I know pressure in the public sector how could we reduce tuition right now? We are, all of us in the public sector, from University of Illinois to Governor State University, every one of us is trying to be creative and to invest in a very strong student experience right now. Our tuitions are already low and subsidized by the state. And there's, you know, we still have to pay, we not only do we have to pay the faculty, we have to pay the faculty in the summer, for example, to really learn more about creative remote education. So any kind of demand for the publics to reduce tuition is just not realistic. It's not really taking into account, you know, what it is we're trying to do, you know, in terms of, you know, the three principles of respect science, respect each other, and be creative. So I get very impatient, you know, with the calls for the publics to reduce tuition.
As a graduate of the University of Illinois, where I think I got a first class education at a very, very low rate when I was in school, we were talking hundreds of dollars a year, not thousands. Then going to an Ivy League law school. And there's no doubt that I think it opened doors to me that might not have otherwise been opened having gone to an Ivy League school, and introduced me to people that have, that are my lifetime friends, who are all outstanding individuals. So there are pros and cons of everything. I got a great education at a very low cost as an in-state student, and think it's all terrific. And I also, as someone who spent a significant portion of my career as a corporate officer, I understand the economics of it and the costs. You have to pay faculty, you have to pay for the facilities, you have to pay for the maintenance, you have to pay for supplies. You aren't wasting money. And also, as going through with you, the budget crisis in Illinois, where you weren't getting any money, and how you managed to continue educating students during that time is just phenomenal. So I think that may be a whole nother discussion that would be worthwhile for people to really think about what is the cost of education, but keeping in mind the possibility that even though, for example, in Illinois, they weren't even paying what they were supposed to pay to maintain the universities that are state-run universities, but still the idea of free tuition at community colleges is an idea whose time may have come, and it's something that we need to think about in terms of the future of our society, where schooling is necessary for the economy. It's necessary for people to get the jobs that pay well. They have to have certain educational background. But that's a whole different conversation. And I think that unless you have something that you would like to add, you know, something we didn't ask about that you think is essential for our listeners to know as schools begin the tough part of reopening with social distancing and sanitary measures that will protect students if they are in class.
Let me just say something that we didn't really cover, and leadership matters. And I just want to do a shout out to Governor Pritzker.
Yes.
And to Mayor Lori Lightfoot, because I really do believe that the three principles that I articulated about respect science, respect each other, and be creative are really exemplified in both of them. And it makes a huge difference. And I have served under a number of different governors in this state. And I think we are fortunate that we have Governor Pritzker right now.
Yes.
And I think that the general framework that he's established for the state and for the openings and the different phases is really important. So I just want to make, I certainly want to make point of that. And also just to let viewers and listeners know that when this pandemic first struck in March, the public university presidents were on conference calls with the governor's office just about daily, including weekends, as we sorted out, you know, what the science was saying and you know, just what it would mean for us in terms of public universities. And I know that support from the governor's office and from the Illinois Board of Higher Education have continued, and that's very important to the state. And it's a model for other states, because I think we've all seen other ways of dealing with this issue.
Thank you, Elaine. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we are a very lucky state to have Governor Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot. I think they have both been extraordinary in leading us and will continue to do so. So thank you for mentioning that. I'm very happy with that. So Elaine, as you've said, respect science, and that means everyone should be wearing a mask. And respecting others, everyone should be wearing a mask, because you may be asymptomatic and you don't want to infect someone else. So please, everyone, respect science.
Good, thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk with both of you.
Thank you so much.
We hope you listening also enjoyed this episode. Be sure to follow us on YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, and send us suggestions, ideas for future topics and speakers you'd like to see via Jill, myself, or our website. Lastly, Intergenerational Politics is now on Apple Podcasts, so be sure to subscribe and rate our channel to support us. Thanks for listening, and see you on our next episode.